This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. On this episode of the show, we're talking why upland hunters miss with Chris Batha. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 238. All right, welcome to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Thank you for joining us, everybody. We've got a great conversation coming up for you today with Chris Batha. We will get to that in just a few moments. I do want to thank Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast, those of you out there making voluntary contributions to the show, supporting our efforts to keep these great conversations coming your way. As a thank you to them, they get access to some bonus content, Patreon giveaways. We set everybody up with some Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers. You can learn more and sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Everybody else, if you love the show and you want to do something really simple, feel free to leave the show a rating, a review, subscribe to the show, follow the show, tell a friend about an episode you liked, share the Birdshot Podcast with your hunting buddy. Every little bit helps, and I appreciate you taking the time to do so. All right, let's talk why upland hunters miss with Chris Batha. The timing of this show is just about perfect. I am recording this intro the day before I leave for my first hunting trip of the year. I'll be heading out to hunt sharptails and huns on my annual trip with friends. Can't wait. It's going to be a blast. When you are hearing this, I will be at the tail end of my trip and just about ready to head home if I haven't started doing so already. So I will either be smiling and laughing when this episode hits the airway, or perhaps gritting my teeth and burying it another year after struggling to find my shotgunning skills early in the season as I did a year ago. If you may recall, I think I mentioned it on the episode with Chris today. I came home from my sharptail trip last year and had some issues with my shotgunning, which is nothing out of the norm, but it was something the guys I was with and I all got a good laugh about when all was said and done, and I eventually sorted things out. I'm relatively confident that won't happen this year, but I'm probably jinxing myself just by saying that. So we shall see, and maybe on a future episode, you'll hear how things eventually played out. But nonetheless, I read an article recently in Shooting Sportsman that Chris Batha wrote titled simply, Why Upland Hunters Miss. And he went through a list of things, common reasons for and mistakes that we might make that would cause us to miss our target or miss the bird. And I thought, with it being mid-September, what better time to talk a little wing shooting, education, and instruction with one of the best. So I think you'll enjoy this one. And as I say on the episode, I would highly recommend Chris's book, The Instinctive Shot, A Practical Guide to Modern Wing Shooting. You can find it on Amazon just about anywhere. It is a great, great book. Got it on my bookshelf. It's very well broken out, very straightforward, and there's a lot of stuff in there that you can look back on and reference from time to time. It's a really, really great fundamental book about shotguns and shooting as it pertains to wing shooting and upland hunting. So with that said, let's welcome into the conversation and onto the Birdshot Podcast, Chris Batha. My pleasure to welcome Chris Batha to the Birdshot Podcast today. Thanks for joining us today, Chris.
Hey, I'm very happy to do so. So I'm looking forward to the hour or so.
Absolutely. It's going to be a fun conversation and a very timely one. Why upland hunters miss, going to be the focus of our conversation today. We are just about ready to begin many, many hunting seasons around the country, and it's an exciting time of year for all of us, I imagine yourself included, Chris. What's on your mind this time of year? Are you getting ready to do trips? I know you're probably still doing some gun fitting, but what does Chris's fall schedule look like?
The fall schedule for myself and clients I've got, a lot of them travel to Europe and down to South America, and a lot of upland bird shooting. Obviously, the different seasons come in, so you can start looking at wildfowl. Mostly, I enjoy all shooting, but I really do like hunting the smaller birds, you know, quail and so on and so forth. I like the covey rises. They do exactly what they're supposed to do to a fox, you know, like mm-hmm. and skedaddle his brain with all kinds of birds flying in different directions. This one, that one. And I think it's one of the best, especially with wild birds, one of the best shooting experiences is the upland birds.
Yeah, indeed. So I have to ask, might you, every year, do you go over, do you go overseas for the Glorious 12th? I'll start with that.
Yeah, the Glorious 12th is one of those ones. The grouse is the most expensive shooting in Europe, although they aren't in Europe, it's in Scotland and England.
Yeah.
The grouse live in grouse moors, and the grouse moors are owned by the aristocracy, and it's a very expensive form of shooting. You can get a different one where you can actually walk up the birds as you would as an upland bird hunter, and but the grouse are just they're strange little critters. They're quite funny. And they ka-ka-ka-ka, then it sounds like get back, you know, and they'll all march up. And so you're walking up, and the heather is soft, so you have to lift your legs up. So it's quite, you have to be fit to get, you know, to be out there. You walk a lot, shoot a little, unless you're lucky enough to be shooting driven grouse, and then you've got a loader, and you sit in the butt, and the birds are driven towards you. So that's the landed gentry with really deep pockets.
Yeah.
So the walking up grouse is very special. The birds are wild, you know, truly wild, and they get out of dodge and they skim over the top of the heather, you know, almost like small fighter jets.
Yeah.
And especially with the heather all purple at that time of year, and just everything about it, the tweeds and everything blending into the background so that the birds won't cross off, you know, and break away from the covey because of movement.
Yeah.
And it's just it is probably, you know, it should be on your on your bucket list, is to try and get out, unless you're lucky enough, as I say, to have the lord of the manor to invite you to shoot grouse, you know, from grouse butts.
Yeah.
But if you can get, you know, and there's lots of places that offer walked up grouse, that is a really great experience, and one, as I say, that, you know, I can repeat myself, should be on the bucket list of all upland bird hunters.
Yeah, it's. Have you ever had the chance to hunt sharp-tailed grouse here out on the prairies?
I've done a little bit of that, but no, I haven't really got into the sharp-tails because just simply where we are. So
right.
You know, I've done quail and the different, you know, all the way through, but no, I'm not the sharp-tails. Well, that's a great-looking bird, and I would have said it was something like the rough grouse. Yeah. Well, not the rough grouse, the red grouse.
Yeah,
England.
Yeah,
a similar bird. You know,
that's really why I asked, because I've of course never had the chance to do walked-up grouse shooting overseas, but you see the terrain and the grouse moors and the heather, and just kind of think rolling short cover terrain and those. It's a native grouse species, so I wonder if there are some parallels. I'm sure maybe somebody out there listening has had a chance to do or see both.
Well, I've shot up, walked up grouse and driven grouse when, yep, I've been lucky enough. But the I'd say those two birds are very similar. You know, the flight pattern, how they break. You know, the red grouse will chatter, and you know, they to each other, you know.
Yeah.
And then I don't know if they're all saying like, "Get ready, we're going," and that's when the covey takes off. Like, but that's what it sounds like. They're organizing, you know, the breakout of the first drive.
Is it typically done with pointing dogs? From in your experience?
Yes, yeah. They'll have some Cocker Spaniels and some little Jack Russells and everything.
Sure.
Because the some of the grouse will get right underneath the heather. You know, when you're walking on there, you think you're walking up big solid hills, but the heather is quite deep. And it when you press down with your foot on it, it's sort of like there's no reaction, like, you know, there's no thrust back up. So it's quite tiring because you have to lift your legs up higher than you normally would on solid ground. So the walked-up grouse is really exciting in the fact that, you know, you have flankers on the outside, the people shooting, everybody's got to be aware of everybody because these birds will just take off in all directions. And so you move up, and it's all of a sudden you'll get grouse that will hold steady, and then just suddenly out of nowhere, you know, just explode like somebody threw a hand grenade into the heather. And a lot of the times it's amazing, you know, somebody will say, which one did you knock down, or did you knock anything down? And he'll turn around and say, I never got time to pull the trigger. Yeah. And so, you know, you're out there for, if you're lucky, to do 2 days, but even if you do a full day, it's a fabulous experience. And as you get used to how the grouse are, because they all talk to each other, and they get up and fly, and they just cover over the contours of the ground and drop in again.
Yeah.
And there isn't a great deal of shooting like the driven, but there's enough shooting and enough challenge to make it one of the best shooting experiences you can have.
Yeah. The sound, I don't recall hearing it. I'll have to go look up a video, but it certainly made, when you said that, it made me think of a group of sharptails getting up and kind of laughing at you, chugga, 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 as they fly away. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree entirely with that. That's a little alarm system.
Yeah.
You know, that they don't know there isn't a fox or something or a ferret getting involved in the heather. Yeah. It's like another, you know, it's just get out of jail, you know, choom, gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. They are a wonderful bird to watch, especially the driven, which is extremely expensive. But when you're in a grouse butt, or even if you're beating, you'll see the birds get underneath the heather, and they'll run along underneath the heather, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you'll just get this huge covey. Your covey doesn't sum it up, basically. You might have as many as 60 or 80 hundred birds, depending on how well they don't work well in captivity, so they have to be truly wild.
Yeah.
And they just sort of they all lift as one, like fighter jets, and they all just go down the side of the moors. They seem to drift off and down the moors using it, and it's just spectacular to watch them, how they fly and change and jink and everything else. And it's probably the reason why it's the most expensive, you know, bird shooting, driven bird shooting there is. And usually it's Lordship's land and his friends.
Yeah. Just that being a wild bird species, you can't raise them in captivity. I mean, that plays into it. But yeah, that's, again, so many parallels there with sharp-tailed grouse. And I guess it's not surprisingly, just given where they evolved in the landscapes. But yeah, that's, I'm getting excited. I'm a week or two out from my trip west to hunt sharp-tails. And when you get that group rising, as you say, when they all do it at the same time, you know, it's just amazing. You're walking along and you the grass is ankle high, and you're thinking, how could there, you know, the dog's on point, and how could there be birds here? I don't see anything. And then all of a sudden this group of birds takes to wing, and it's incredible. That's what we all love.
Yeah, it's one of those things where their wings, where they're getting their first drive off the ground, and their wings are almost slapping above them, and they're all moving and changing and everything else. And going back to a fox or anything, trying to catch one, you know, snapping at it, it's got little chance, in my opinion. They're exactly like the red grouse. They just get out of dodge.
Yeah. Well, we'll transition here in a minute, but I will ask, because you mentioned, if somebody does have this on their bucket list, or takes your advice and puts it on their bucket list, what do you recommend if somebody was really interested in trying a trip like this? Do they get in touch with you, or do they go to a different outlet? How does somebody get started in doing a walk up grouse hunt?
Yeah, the all of the grouse mowers, there's small ones, big ones, large ones. And then also the grouse are truly wild, so you can't put them out like, you know, they do with pheasants and so on. So what happens is they have to count the number of birds, because they have to have enough left over at the end of the season to get another, you know, for the next season, so that there's enough birds to carry on the shooting and looking after the birds and the moors, you know. So they'll shoot the walked up. They use it for counting. So when they go out, there might be 10 or 15 of you in a big row across, because these grouse moors are God's lost wilderness. It's just all heather and hills and rolling. It's spectacular, unless you're walking in it. Anyway, and when you're going along, what will happen is all of a sudden you might get one will get out when you're walking, and he'll get off, or you might get a covey of anywhere between 6, 10, 12, just depending on the outer coveys or other birds mated that season and how many birds they can afford to shoot. So they have a counter of an evening, the gamekeepers on the moors, they go out with a counter and a dog, and they click how many grouse they see or they put up as they go along. Mm-hmm. And then from there, they can work out how many times they can allow day shooting, you know, like walked-up shooting, or how many times they can, through that season, how many times they can put through the driven grouse. And it's really is talk about looking after nature and everything people say about shooting. If it wasn't for the grouse moors, there wouldn't be any grouse.
Yeah. Excellent. All right, Chris. Well, I appreciate that. I wasn't part of the plan to go into that a little bit, but I figured I would ask. It is August, and it's now September, and as we mentioned, a lot of people will be out hunting. Well, when they hear this will be second week of September or so, and so hunting season will have started. And I thought we would get you on the show because I was reading a recent issue of Shooting Sportsman, and there was an article in there by you. You write in there pretty much every issue, and it was Why Upland Hunters Miss. So that's certainly a topic of interest anyways with folks listening to this, but listeners of my show may recall about a year ago when I returned from my sharptail hunting trip, I had a friend on, and we discussed some of my shooting woes. I had some shooting woes out west last year, and it was mainly shotgun related and just kind of my lack of patterning and understanding the shotgun I was shooting, and a little bit getting in my head as tends to happen to some of us. So I thought, what better time to bring Chris on and talk through a few of the reasons why upland hunters miss. Again, the article was in Shooting Sportsman recently, and we're gonna use that as our template for this conversation moving forward. So, Chris, why don't we start off with we're just gonna kind of work down this list, and you had posed a bunch of reasons why we might miss in the field. So unless you want to jump in with anything ahead of that, poor gun mount is top of the list, at least as far as the article goes.
Yeah, there's a combination there, though. The gun has to fit to have, you know, you can't have a poor gun mount and the gun fitting goes out the window. You have to have you have to have a good gun mount. They're essentially together.
Yeah.
It's not one or the other. They're like, you could almost say it's a team. So gun fitting's essential because people come in all shapes and sizes, and you know, long cheekbones, you know, long necks, high cheekbones. They need a gun sometimes with a Monte Carlo stock to get so they can put their head in a natural position to get good eyesight onto the birds they're shooting or good look at the birds. And others, you know, they fit the Mr. 5'10" that weighs 165 pounds, and they're all happy. But it goes from the very tall person to the very short person, and they need gun fittings. It's an essential part of it. Otherwise, you're lifting your head up to see down the barrel, or you're pushing your head down to try and see down the rib, and all of this fidgeting and head movement, an eighth of an inch on the gun. When you lift your head up an eighth of an inch, the barrel has moved up at 2 feet at 40 or 50 yards. You know, so the actual gun fit and gun mount are a combination that are essential to really consistent upland bird shooting.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like many times when I miss in the field, I would say the most common thing, as you pointed out, I usually will have some idea that I made a bad gun mount. That's a very, very common cause of a miss. You just know that something didn't feel right. Maybe you don't know exactly why or where you missed the bird, but something didn't feel right in the gun mount. And if we mounted the gun perfectly every time, we would all shoot a lot better. But it's hard to do, and there's a number of reasons why that is. It could be the terrain, could be the cover, could be just the rush and the thrill of the birds getting up. I know I've been victim of every one of those and many more. What makes a good gun mount, Chris? I wonder if we could build that foundation a bit.
Yeah, the gun mount, first of all, it's definitely the gun needs to fit for a start, and then there's the gun mount, and you can't have one without the other. They're joined at the hip, and the gun fitting is to first of all you get the person, and you have to get him to have good stance, posture, and head position, and that's the fundamentals. You know, footwork comes into it for the upland bird shooter, but you have to create the right shape for the gun to come into your shoulder pocket and the column of the stock to be underneath your zygomatic buttress or cheekbone. Mm. And that should be an anchor to where every time you mount the gun when a bird flushes, you know, you do use footwork and step into the line, but the gun comes into your cheekbone, your eyes, the rear sight, looking down over the gun to the bird. And then the lead and how the bird's jinking, that's all Mother Nature. So, but the gun fitting is an essential, and the gun mount, they're hand in glove. They are easily the most fault of missing is gun fitting, poor gun mount, poor footwork. You know, and you can talk to some of the best shots ever, and they'll tell you the best movement that ever, you know, is that you your poor footwork is followed by your poor gun mount is easily the most fault of missing,
yeah,
followed by footwork, where they don't move their feet. In other words, they don't step into the line of flight and make the shot, so they're releasing their body to swing the gun correctly. They lock up, i.e. the hips and the upper torso, that they lock up. And so that's when you, if you ever stand behind some people shooting, especially on a clays course as well, you see them rolling from one foot to the other. So their shoulders, we call it windscreen wiping in the trade. They look like they're wiping a windscreen on a car's glass.
And so when it comes to the gun mount, that is again, it's a common cause of miss, being a poor gun mount. But fortunately, working in our favor, a gun mount is something that we can practice even at home. And I know there's some methods described in your book, The Instinctive Shot, which I mentioned to you. I'd read that a couple of years ago and took a bunch of notes. And I would love to get you back on at some point. We'll dive deeper into some of that stuff. But what are some of the ways that we can work on our gun mount at home? Because this is something that I've incorporated over the last handful of years, that I feel like it's you're greasing the groove in a way that when I do make a bad gun mount, I know that because I've practiced so many good gun mounts at home.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I always use and use for people, especially when I'm doing gun fittings with people, is I have a mirror on the wall at head height, and I have a hula hoop with a dotted 2 on 12 o'clock and on the ring of the hula hoop, and at 2 o'clock on the thing. So the feet are perfectly, they can't not do what I want them to do. So they put the left foot on the one mark and the right foot on the right foot. This is for right to left shooters.
Yep.
And the left person turns it around. And that allows you to turn essentially through 180 degrees. And then what you want to do is, if there's a shelf, I put some cartridges on there with the brass showing out and different gaps between them, so the person can mount onto the first cartridge, swing to see the lead on the second cartridge, and then follow through, you know, which would be your lead. And then he can come back the other way and turn his feet into his non-thing, and he can come back, see the lead, see, you know, the bird. Man, you know, this is all imaginary.
Mm-hmm.
And the good way to use it is you can buy a laser cartridge. You can get them anywhere, in Walmart or whatever. And it drops in the 12 gauge, and when you pull the trigger, the laser triggers. So if you're practicing at home and you've got a shelf or angles, you can get your body in the right shape, your footwork and everything, and then see the laser. You know, you don't rush. You smoothly move the laser along the lines of beams and along the lines of the joint of wall and ceiling. And that's just a great way to smooth your gun mount and improve your gun mount and everything else. And as I say, the deadliest move a bird shooter can make is with his feet. So yeah, you start practicing your footwork.
Now, I've seen some different, this is kind of a side note, but I've seen some different laser mechanisms where I've seen one that drops into the bore and then there's like a cord and it actually attaches to the trigger. So when you depress the trigger or you're pressing on the trigger, you're not actually, you know, dry firing the gun, but then it points the laser at the wall. It sounds like the one you're talking is much more simple. I don't have something like that. Is it really something that you do? You just kind of turn the laser on, drop it in the bore, and then it's on. And then as I'm mounting the gun and swinging around and following the corners of my ceiling and walls, the laser's going along with it.
Yeah, the ones that I use is in particular is it's just a brass one. But it's got a soft top on it, so you can drop it, you know, it's not on all the time. You drop it into the chamber of the shotgun, and then, you know, along the line you're using, or the wall, or whatever.
Yep.
And you, when you pull the trigger, so I usually put two cartridges up, say 4 feet apart, and I move to the first one, and then swing out to the second one and pull the trigger, and the laser detonates, and you can see you've got hard focus on the, as you would be on the bird, but the gun's in your peripheral vision, and the laser hits the, you know, like the amount of lead you need and where you're mounting. As I say, I like to do it along lines and walls and ceilings.
Yeah.
And it's a really good way to improve your gun mount, because there's a visual reference to it every time you do it.
Yeah, so it's really, it's like a snap cap, essentially, that...
Yeah, it, that's what it is. It is okay. A snap cap, but all it's got inside is a little spring with a lid, so you can close it, and you can either fire it and it will come on, or you can just close it and get the light on full time, and it's good for the lines of walls and ceilings and gun mount drills, and, I must buy so many of them, because as soon as somebody sees one, I give it them, you know, during a lesson or whatever, and we're there, and I always start indoors, because, you know, you take somebody outside and all they want to do is go pull the trigger.
Sure.
And they get it with a laser so quickly, you know, the walls and lines, the ceilings, that they always end up buying it off me. You know, can I have it and take it away? And I it doesn't bother me. I just order another couple. But it really works well in learning, you know, the controlling, because you've got this continuous visual aid memoir going on, whatever you can think. And it works really well.
Do you happen to know the brand name of it, or perhaps you could send it to me later?
Yeah, I could find it later for you. It's basically, I'll make a little note of that, but I buy them on, I'll get it for you, the laser thing. I'll get it back to you.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll put a note for that, and we'll put it in the show notes for people.
Yeah, no problem.
Excellent. That's something, you know, again, I've seen these things, but I've never actually bought one, and I some of the ones I've seen are a little bit more involved than the way that one sounds. So that one sounds real simple. So,
a lot of people have got them where they stick them in the end of the barrel, and there's a wire come down and sits on their finger, and then they pull the trigger, and they're all good.
Yeah.
But I've just found this one. You drop it in the chamber, you close it up, it comes on, and you can, you know, I usually put. Things for lead, so I'll put something dead in the center in front of me. I'll keep looking at it and move the gun off to the left 4 feet, and then come back to the middle. Keep looking at the cartridge laser and move it off to the right, you know, 4 feet, and then come back, and you've got the laser, showing you whether you're seesawing the gun mount, or you're lifting your head up to see what's going on, or you're transferring weight from one foot to the other and rolling your shoulders and hence the gun off the line. And it's great if you're indoors, because you've got wonderful lines of walls and ceilings, and, you know, if you could open up on the woodwork, you know, where you can drop an angle and shoot an angle and stuff. You know, barns are excellent for it, but, you know, garages, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, you can have your own little workout room.
Exactly. Yes. I can see myself doing it out here in the office already. I'm sure some of the listeners have these things too, so we'll probably get some more recommendations. But you mentioned something there that I think, having seen our mutual friend Del Whitman do a lot of gun fittings over the years, and talking to you quite a bit, one thing that's very common that I think, as you pointed out, the laser would be great for that, is if somebody has not focused on it before, when they're going through the gun fitting process, what they'll realize is a lot of people have a lot of excess muzzle movement. You said seesaw. So when you're mounting the gun, the muzzle will dip down sharply and then come back up to the target. And in working with Dell and watching these gun fittings, you know, you really want to minimize any excess muzzle movement. You want to keep a very focused muzzle movement directly to the bird and keep that. And this is all sort of built into the gun mount and keep that from teeter-tottering. Boy, what a great example. The laser would highlight that for somebody immediately if you see that laser jumping all over the wall.
Yeah, if you see the better shot, you know, the more consistent shots, even in clay shooting, you know, the really top shooters, it looks like they hardly move.
Yes.
You know, they have good footwork, the gun's in its right place, it comes into their cheek, they're turning it with the big muscles of the body, not lifting and throwing it around with the arms. And they point out with the arms and the hands, and you know, they're looking at the target hard and whether it goes left, right, up or down. They apply the lead and shoot it, and it's all one smooth motion. And the trouble is, they make it look so smooth, they look so quickly, and so you get other people trying to emulate them, and they'll get the gun, and they'll first of all they'll do is yank the stock into their shoulder pocket, yeah. So the barrels drop about a foot. And then they recover from that and find another foot. But meanwhile, the clay target or the bird's still going. Yep. And then you finally get to it and fire. And you know, it's a hit or miss. You know, do you hit it or do you miss it? And I think the laser is such a great tool to use, as long as you use it smoothly and carefully and don't go rushing with it, just to get that turning of the body, you know, the feet in the right place, the turning of the body, the mounting of the gun, and the lines of walls and ceilings up pillars. And it's amazing how quickly somebody, only 5-10 minutes of an evening, you know, where it's safe to obviously leave a shotgun or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you come in and you might think, well, I'll do 10 gun mounts, or I'll do 10 diagonals, you know, where I drop the shoulder because I could be shooting up on hilly land. And now you've got a different terrain to come into. If it's flat, it's everything's good. But if you've got a hill, you've now got to drop the shoulder to get the barrels back on the same trajectory as the birds flying. So it's a very good tool to get.
Yeah, I'm gonna order one as soon as you send me the one that you like to use, because I'm smiling over here because I mentioned earlier I do practice gun mounts in the garage in the office. I've been doing that, but even when I'm doing that, I will catch myself snapping the gun up to my shoulder, you know, just this real fast jerky motion, and I keep saying I don't have one of these lasers, it would be so evident, but I am aware of it, and I recognize that that's not what I want to be doing, but it's almost like just this urge to get the gun up fast when slower and smoother is better than that fast jerky motion.
Oh, it's once again, if you see the big boys, you know, the champion shooters and so on and so forth, and really great bird shooters, you know, the high bird people in Europe, where they're shooting birds at like 40, 50 yards in the air, and they're bringing down pairs. And you know, obviously, they've got a lot of money. they've trained a lot. They've shot a lot. They've had a lot of tuition and everything. But everything's, they've all got the same thing. They've got a really good gun mount, excellent footwork, and they you know, a really hard focus. They capture the bird, and they're not looking at the gun at all, because the gun fit is you know, proper gun fit. You can't have a good gun fit without a good gun as such, and you have to get your gun not made to measure, but to fit, so that your eye looks exactly the same place down the rib and out to the bird every time, and that's what they do. They've got their art focus, they've got their footwork, and they've got a really smooth gun mount, and they look effortless.
Yeah,
they actually look like they were on a stage, you know, like in a big. If you're watching a line of guns in Europe, then because of all the footwork and the dropping of the shoulders and the angles of the guns, because you're on hills and things. And they literally look like they could be on a film set or you know, at a show. They're so sort of coordinated and articulate.
Yeah. Let's talk footwork a little bit. We've hit on a few of these things, yeah. and a lot of them will come up throughout the conversation, I think. But yeah. Poor footwork. So you mentioned the when you had somebody standing in your office and kind of mounting, practice mounting 12 and 2. So folks can envision that. It's kind of a forward-facing little – Dell will always say 45-degree. It's kind of the same yeah. same stance, roughly shoulder-width apart. Anyways, I don't want to get too into that because that's sort of practicing. And if you were standing on a peg, but how do we focus on our footwork? Or are there any things that you do to encourage good footwork for somebody that is out walking behind a dog and moving over uneven terrain? And you know, we're not standing in one place waiting for the birds to come to us. We're walking towards birds or walking towards a spot. How do we think about footwork in that scenario?
Yeah, well, if we take it from an upland bird sense where, you know, birds are in cover or they're in coveys or individuals yeah. away from it, the old thing about it is it's a different thing. If we're talking about driven game shooting and you know, whatever one it will be, grouse, partridge, pheasant, they're, it goes back to landed gentry. They've got their loader, they've got the Tapera guns, they've got everything there, and they've got their footwork. Whereas we go around to the other side, and the upland bird hunter, you know, what he's got is he's got a gun and he's got footwork, but he's going to be walking. He's going to have to see how he's going to, you know, his personal way of carrying the gun safely, but effectively he can mount it when a bird, you know, might catch him out in a flush. And it's once again, it's footwork, though, you know, as you're walking along, and all of a sudden the bird breaks cover, what you do is the deadliest move a bird shooter can make is to step into the line of flight.
Yeah.
Because if you step into the line of flight, the gun has moved to the bird and your body shape has turned so you can turn through 180 degrees and hopefully you take this bird in the middle of that thing right down the tunnel as such. And that's what it's about. It's about hard focus. You know, you have soft focus when you're walking. The hard focus is triggered by the bird and the wings and and then you just make that. You don't get excited and dash it in your shoulder and swing it around like you're conducting an orchestra. You just make that smooth, trapezius move and pull the trigger. And it once you groove it, and the thing is, the person who really takes his time is so much faster than the person who does that kind of like you know. The dance, you know, where they don't move their feet and then they're, you know, they're getting the gun and they mount it in the shoulder twice and drop their head once and then they realize they can't turn and they're bending their body to make the gun go somewhere and you know, they wonder why this guy over here is smooth and efficient and he shoots consistently well and they wonder why they're not shooting consistently well, but it's because none of the fundamentals have been really grooved and put in place to allow them to make these, you know, smoother shots at distance and so on and so forth. And the hills come into it as well, you know, when you're walking around the sides of hills and so on. Yeah, you know, now we're getting to, you need ankle support, really good ankle support for that kind of shooting, because a lot of the time, some of those little pathways that you work your way around, the stone has moved over the years and everything else, and it's very easy to slip or you know, make a mistake. And so really good boots and, you know, so ankle support, good tread,
yeah,
and so on, you know, they're an essential part of your shooting, and you should be wearing those when you practice your gun mount in the mirror, because you'll be making that little step to the left or a little step to the right, and you know, use the equipment that you're going to use in the season.
Yeah, excellent. And so, again, a lot of these things that you're talking about, they are things that when all is said and done and we are in the moment in the field hunting birds, a lot of this will be unconscious or subconscious, but
yeah.
It's working on little things and little pieces of the puzzle at home when you're consciously thinking about them helps you when you are in that moment, and it helps you do them smoother and more fluidly.
Yeah, see, you know, like it's like the Karate Kid, you know,
yes,
wax on,
yes.
Wax off. And then he goes, Mr. McGarry, all you're doing is you're using me to, you know, like to polish the car or wash the windows. And he goes, show me, bring, you know, paint the fence. And of course, he blocks the kick.
Exactly.
Well, it's the same thing. You know, if you get kids before they've, you know, got into bad things, and their eyes are tested. You know, you test them for eye dominance, so you make them shoot right or left-handed according to their eye dominance. And then you start working with them, and the laser is useful because they can get a reaction to what they're doing, and you work with them and work with them and work with them, and they just groove it all. And it's amazing how you'll get one of the youngsters again, the young men now, and they'll come back with dad or, you know, like uncle, and they come back, and the dad's still got the same faults that he had when I was teaching him, you know, like 20 years ago or whatever, and boys here, and he's like a clockwork toy because he's got it all grooved out. And of course, the dad's as proud as, you know, of his boy, but the fact is, the boy hasn't got any of the faults.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he never learned them in the first place. You know, he just grooved the right stuff in the first place.
Yeah, awesome. All right, let's talk about focus a little bit, because that's next on the list. And I recall when I was reading your book, there was some interesting information in there about focus, and something that I'd kind of, I guess, realized in shooting, and mainly when I'm at the Clays course is, you know, we talk about this hard focus on the target, so this laser-like focus on the target, and I think it was in your book that I was reading, like, that you really can only maintain that for a relatively short period of time, and it's all part of this gun mount. And you mentioned it earlier, soft focus, when, let's say we've got a dog on point, we're walking in, soft focus would be kind of that you're seeing more peripheral vision, you're relaxed, you're taking in the surroundings because you don't know exactly where the bird is. Then the bird gets in the air, and that's when we snap to that laser-like focus. First of all, is that correct? And then how do we think about those things, and how do we work on them?
Well, you've described it well. Basically, it's referred to as pursuit movement. And what pursuit movement is, and it goes back to the animals and so on and so forth. We evolved from animals, you know, from the chimpanzees. So what happens is, when something moves in our peripheral vision, we automatically look at it. Mm. You know, you must have been in your office at one time, and somebody walks past the door, and you automatically turn to look at what went past the door.
Yep.
And it's pursuit movement. So every person and the evolvement of the Homo sapiens, what happens is you don't look at the gun. That's why it's so important to have gun fit, and a gun that fits. And what you do is you soft focus with your eyes. So you just rest your eyes out where you think the bird's going to flash, or if you're already seeing a bird come in. And what happens is pursuit movement happens, where one eye sees it, your dominant eye, and fixes on the bird. The second eye will look at the bird, and that will be a triangle into your two eyes. So that gives you size and distance, spatial vision. So that's how you can see the gun in your peripheral vision and maintain hard focus on the target, be it a clay pigeon or a live bird. Your total focus is on the bird. It's out past the gun on the bird. And in your peripheral, you know, you think how you drive your car. You know, you get in your truck, and you drive up the freeway, and you're looking through the window. How do you keep it between the other cars, between you, you know, in their lanes? And it's peripheral vision. Your peripheral vision is looking to where the car is safe in the lanes, and your pursuit movement is looking out the front because somebody might cut you up and cause a problem. So it's throughout nature, whether it's a rabbit or a human being, with the pursuit movements, a natural reaction to movement. And that's where it goes wrong a lot of times with people who've just started shooting or they've learned bad habits, is where they snatch the gun up, punch it into their shoulder pocket, and then seesaw it two or three times till their cheek's in a comfortable place, and make the shot. Well, in that period of a minute, 90 seconds, like, it's like a semaphore. The gun's gone past the target, back to the target, past the bird, back to the bird. And what you really want is precision pointing. You know, the big muscles of the body turn the gun. Your head and eyes are following the gun, and you're looking at the bird, and you just, it just happens. You know, it's almost like you've got a Picasso with a paintbrush, and you're just finishing off a little touch of, you know, sky or grass or something. It's all about everything's got to be calm. Everything's got to be smooth.
Yeah.
Smooth's the better word for it. And it's training yourself in the mirror, training yourself in the lines, walls and ceilings, having some lessons if needed, and then working you out. So, you know, you work on your footwork, get a little medicine ball, 8 pounds, same weight as a gun, put it on a shelf or a drawer, the way you can pick it up and turn and put it down, pick it up and turn. So you're building all those muscles and strength in the arms. And it all eventually arrives in the one place where, you know, somebody will say, God, he's a great shot. And what it is he's probably put about 6 to 10 years into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you can cut that down to a year if you've got the time to train. But it's learning the right muscle memories and the eyes, how the eyes work. That combination, as I say, usually the biggest things I see is the gun fitting is essential, and nobody gets a gun fit. They just buy it over the shelf. Poor gun mount, and early, easily the most fault of missing is poor gun mount. Poor footwork is followed by, you know, poor footwork, what I'm saying. And then lack of focus, hands and eyes on the bird always. And people don't, they move the gun quicker than their eyes move. And so the eyes leave the gun, lose the gun. You know, the gun goes out, it's there, but it's not in a straight line where it should be. And then, as I say, then eye dominance issues, which we've seen is need application of looking for help in learning to hard focus. It's also to do with eye dominance is, you know, left or right. Do you change shoulders when they're children? You know, like, you can see their left eye, right eye dominant, so you test and teach them to shoot left-handed. And a lot of the parents will teach them right-handed because that's how they've learned to shoot. So they've always got this cross-dominance
right.
issue going on. And vice versa, it's like people growing up, you know, they're getting older and then they take up shooting later. And yeah, it's more now, people, a lot of good instructors now, they'll start them off on the, you know, I say the right shoulder, the left or the right shoulder that they should be shooting from.
Correct.
For the right
shoulder,
footwork,
yeah.
You know, left or right, and they should be, you know, stance, posture, and so on and so forth. So I have a little classroom type thing, and when somebody comes on the first lesson, I spend the morning, well, I take them out in the first place. Look at them shooting, film them on an iPad, bring them back, show them what they're doing wrong on the iPad. Then from there, we start doing a little along the walls and lines and ceilings, along the lines of skateboards, up the corner of the rooms, using lasers and lights. And then when we're quite happy with that, that's we'll go out and shoot the first targets, you know, the thing. And you want to make the first targets not easy, but you know, they can be shot if somebody makes a really nice smooth move and the bird's just got enough spring on it to, you know, to come up and then just hang there for that second. Build the confidence, work on their gun mount, learn to look at the target art.
Yep.
And those are the things. Once again, you know, mentioning eye dominance, it needs a lot of help. You know, it's no good, you know, you can put a dot on your glasses, you can close an eye, you can do whatever you, but it needs some help with the eye dominance, especially if somebody's going to have a gun fitting for a gun and everything else. People say to me, why can it take, you know, 3 hours? And the answer to that is that it takes that because I've got to teach the person to shoot all over again.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that eye dominance one is more common than, you know, a lot of people have eye dominance issues. And it partly sometimes I think because it's not always permanent. You know, you can develop eye dominance issues, fatigue can play into it, but that is one that a lot of people, they don't even realize they're struggling with it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's everything. It's how did you sleep? How did you get up? Did you drive all the way out to the hunt or whatever? And then you went and got your bucket in the dove field and sat down and everything else. Yeah, you know, of course, you've got that. There's no end of you know, lack of focus and eye dominance issues.
Do you have a now, this is definitely somebody like you or a Dell Whitman can walk somebody through some exercises and get a pretty good handle on somebody's eye dominance issue or lack of issue. Do you have a preferred sort of at home method that folks can try just to see if they have any idea if they're to have an issue.
The easiest one in the world and the cheapest one in the world and everything is if you're sitting in your house and you want to look at something like, i.e., at this moment in time, there's a China doll on the shelf about, I don't know, 20 feet away from me. If I hold my thumb up, which I'm left-handed, so I'm holding my left thumb up, and I look really hard at the China thing, I've got two fingers. I've got my thumb and a ghost thumb. And if I was right-handed, which I'm going to do now and come up right-handed, I've got two thumbs again. And it's visual diplopia. It's you can't see in two places with one vision. You have to have one eye on the target and one eye on the gun, or looking down the gun's a better expression. And that's the secret to it, is not you left eye dominant, right eye dominant, whichever. You look at the bird and the guns, your eyes down that, but you've got to put lead on it, and lead is in the peripheral vision. You know, you can see the target in your peripheral vision, or, you know, if it's a straightaway, you can shoot straight at it, no problem. But if you're putting 3 or 4 feet of lead on it, you've got to be pointing the gun 3 or 4 feet away from the target, but maintaining your vision, you know, on the actual target. And so you're looking hard at the target, and then you brush out and pull the trigger, and then the clay breaks or the bird falls out of the sky. But it's all about hard vision. Well, it starts with footwork, stance, posture, and then head, you know, structure, head position, body shape, a gun that fits, and then hard focus, learning that your eyes, I always tell the young kids, and they don't know it anymore, but I always said Wile E. Coyote, when he'd always look down the cliff, and there would be the Roadrunner, you know, and the Roadrunner would go boom and come into perfect vision, you know, like the Roadrunner there. Yeah. And that's what it should look like. You should, you're moving down and you're going down, and when you get to where that bird is and the lead's on it, it should pop. You know, if you're looking right correctly and you're moving the gun at the right speed, if you move the gun too fast, your eyes will go back to the gun because sure. It's the faster moving object. It's the little chimpanzee in the back of our head. It's a fight and defense mechanism. So you've got to make it all calm.
Yeah.
It has to be a calm experience.
Yeah. That is, again, it's one that I mean, I don't know if everybody does. I mean, I'm sure to a certain extent, but you know, when I'm hunting, you know, the bird gets up and that excitement, the excitement of the flush kind of overrides and I always say short circuits my systems. And that's where you get tension in your body. You start to move more. It's a more jerky movement. All of these things, you know, it's just it's a downward spiral. If you get that short circuit and you get out of that flow or that smoothness to it.
Yeah, that's a perfect explanation of it, and probably 80% of the upland bird hunters, you know, because they, you know, they've got businesses, they don't come out and practice enough, they go to the shooting ground occasionally, but, you know, the really great shots are really doing it for a living.
Yeah.
You know, they that's what they do, and then you can become very good and in a reasonable period of time, but it's just understanding, you know, how important it is for things that you never consider, you know, your footwear, you know, supporting the ankles.
Yeah.
The good support, clothing that you can wear, it doesn't snag. In other words, when you're trying to mount your gun, the stock of the gun isn't snagging in the piece of cloth between your bicep and your chest muscle. And that's always a popular one. You see the person trying to snag it, whereas what he should be doing is his gun mount should be pointing the gun out to the bird or out to the clay target. And, of course, the gun comes up into the shoulder pocket on the deltoid, and it's ready to shoot. Whereas you'll see them, they have to get out of the snagged piece of cloth. So they pull the stock down and push it away from them, and then they bring it back under their cheek. But the stock isn't in the shoulder pocket correctly, so the gun's shooting offline.
Yep. Speaking of sort of raising the gun up and lifting the gun, talk about the relationship between the lead hand and the trigger hand in the shotgun. Because I know it was in your book, The Instinctive Shot, where I got a really interesting tip where I can't remember the exact reason why to do it, but you can educate me on that or re-educate me on that. But it was stretching the gun, you know, a feeling of putting a slight tension between your hands, like you're elongating or stretching the gun. And that, I believe that shifted the movement towards your lead hand and helped you sort of raise the gun and push it out with your lead hand.
Yeah. If we just said, you know, like right-handed and you're there and you're going to shoot the bird, You want a little step, if possible, but if you don't need the step, you don't have to have it.
Yeah.
But yes, the gun should be like it's stretched, like it's an elastic band. So your front hand is on the woodwork, you know, the forehand, and pointing the gun out to the barrel, so that your forefinger is now effectively the shot. Your eyes down that rib, looking down past the hand that's holding the gun. The other thing, you want the gun to move like a... That as it comes to the cheek and the hand is pointing out at the bird, your eye should be right down the rib without any conscious reaction to it, because you're looking past it to what you're trying to shoot.
At the target.
Yeah, bang. And that's why, you know, I'll start a lot of people off on clay targets where they're across the field and they come up really high and hang in the air. And so they can start to learn to make this lovely, long, slow, smooth move and break the target. Then when I get the smoothness into them, I can lower the target down, and then the target's got a bit of fizz on it, and then until it's got a lot of fizz on it, and then usually they're getting the gun mount and where their eyes should be, and how their hands and shoulders should work to make the gun mount a complete movement.
Yeah, excellent. All right. Well, I do. I appreciate your comments on fitness or lack of fitness being a reason why upland hunters might miss. And we've touched on a few things. Again, going for a walk, hiking hilly terrain, having the right boots. You mentioned the medicine ball. I've got an 8-pound medicine ball here. I haven't done too many gun mount exercises with it, but I might have to take a tip on that. What other conversation is there around the fitness aspect of things?
One of the biggest things that creates really things is poorly fitting shotguns.
Yeah.
You know, they create more problems, and if you combine it with somebody, you know, like, and I aren't going to make brand names because it's not fair to anything, but they're all much of a match, except when you start going into the really high value guns. But if, you know, when they mass produce a shotgun, it's mass produced for Mr. 5'10" that weighs 85 pounds.
Yeah.
Now, if you're Mr. 5'10", you're pretty lucky.
You're in luck.
And the rest of them, they have to have an extension put on their stock pad, or they don't ever put one on because they don't realize that the stock length is important and the weight of the gun and da-da-da-da-da. And so it's a fitting, you know, it is poorly fitting shotguns create all of the unwanted head movement, all of the seesawing with one hand lifting and one hand pointing. They're not turning the body with the big muscles of the legs and the hips and everything else. They're swapping ankle to ankle and rainbowing and seesawing. And all it needs is a little bit of calmness, a little bit of smoothness. And the best way to go is to go to a clay's course, or if you've got a field with a trap in it, and just get a clay to go away from you about 25 yards, 20 something yards, and just let it go up so you can see all the rings on it, and just let it peak, and the gun movement should be one of, you're standing, you're ready, you go pull and it goes up, and you just, with the gun, you just point the target out and squeeze the trigger gently, and you try to move as smoothly and quietly as you can, and that will just build, you know, you'll just start grooving the smooth movement required to shoot the longer and bigger shots. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about shotgun weight. What are the issues with a shotgun that is too heavy? And then I want to address what the issue would be with a shotgun that's too light. How do we think about a shotgun that might be too heavy for us? That one's probably more obvious than the other one.
Yeah. If they're too heavy, one, you know, they're like, unless you've got the body strength and everything else to be able to, you've got to be safe with a gun in the first instance.
Yeah.
And I've seen occasionally where the gun's been too heavy for a youth and lowered the gun down, and it's not been dangerous, but the barrel's pointing into the ground in front of them, you know, because it's heavy and they've been shooting.
Doesn't have enough control over the gun because it's too heavy.
Yeah, you get control, you know, they're the thing. And they get stronger and bigger and everything else and so on and so forth. It's usually that the shotgun that's being used, you know, like there might be one in the family, you know, that everybody's got, and they want to, them to progress and move on. But I must add that the amount of clay target shooting grounds and the clay target, the youth teams are amazing. The ones at Forest City Gun Club and around the country, they're so small you think to yourself, and you see them on the skate field, the trap field, the sporting clays, and they're as good as most grown-up people.
Yeah.
So I think tuition from the start, if possible, if the finances allow for it, are the things that these youngsters, the youth, and especially a lot of the girls and everything, they come through, they're superb, you know, their gun handling, how safe they are, everything about what they do is professional, and hence, you know, they're moving on through different age groups, and there's a lot of scholarships to be won around the country if you can make a team, you know, a clays team.
Yeah, and then switching over to what issues arise and what are the problems with a gun that might be too light?
Oh, well, if a gun's too light, it's recoil.
Yeah, yeah.
You try, how you control recoil is the shoulder pocket, and then you've got your hand on the grip and the trigger, or the straight grip, depending if it's a field gun, and your hands on the front. Now, the hands should be like shock absorbers. So your hands and arms are actually taking a lot of the recoil in the shoulder pocket is. And, of course, if you've got your weight over your front foot and you're leaning forward, it absorbs a lot of recoil. But you'll see a lot of people who the gun's a little heavy or whatever, they go onto their back foot to control the weight of the gun in the hand. And what they should be doing is getting a bungee cord and putting their foot under it and holding the bungee cord and lifting it up and pointing like they were, and build that left arm up or right arm, depending on what side you're shooting off, and get the strength that you don't have to, you know, move the gun up and down all the time. And then it's just a matter of strength instruction, obviously, and the little quirky things that you teach them, you know, how to do stuff, eyesight, how to look, where to look, you know, this bird needs 10 foot of lead as they get bigger and older, and you can coach them, and you can say, look there, and you put the gun about halfway out, 5 feet, look at it really hard, put another 5 on and pull the trigger. Of course, those 5 feet back here at the gun are inches and feet.
Sure.
Out there, the yards.
Yeah.
And it takes a little bit of learning that you're looking at the clay target over here, and the gun's like 4 feet off to the left, you know, but it's still in your vision.
Yeah.
And those are skill levels that you have to bring them along slowly but surely. And it's great to deal with youth teams because they've got no, you've got a blank blackboard, you know, you can work with them. Whereas if you, and I get a lot of older people, come for gun fittings and shooting and lessons and everything else and so on. And they, like the youth teams are so trained from the beginning that they, you know, as I say, they're just there. They just do what you ask them to do. And that, whereas I have to sometimes start practically all over with getting somebody who's always stood this way and he should be standing that way. You know,
a lot of bad habits.
You know, bad habits. You know, but they're groove bad habits.
Yeah,
and so sometimes it takes, you know, lessons or the thing. I try to write stuff and send things to people and advise them and so on and so forth. But yeah, it's a matter of looking at the person, what they're doing, where they are on their learning curve, or if they're over the learning curve. Because another thing you have to be prepared to do as an instructor is that if you've had somebody that you've been working with for a good while, there's a ceiling on how long you've worked with them. And it might be that somebody else has got, because it's very similar to conversations on this, but there might be somebody who can communicate better with that person. Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah, about a specific issue or thing. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that, you know, as a coach and instructor, you could look at something, or I've had, and look at it and think to myself, well, you know, so-and-so's great with the kids like that. you know, those ones are getting into like 12, 15 and everything. And he's great with them. He's got a great communication with them and everything. So I will, you know, literally introduce, you know, him to people that I've worked with, or the parents have asked me to do some stuff, and said, look, you know, Harry's a really good guy to work with. He's just got a knack with them. So it's no good being stuck in your way, and like, my way is the highway, and this is how it happens, or it doesn't happen at all. You've got to be flexible and be prepared to try different things, and actually realize that you're not communicating correctly with someone, and somebody else might be able to, you know, get a better take out of it. So, you know, none of us are geniuses. We might think we are.
yeah, some do. I think that's a great point, Chris. I think it's one of those things that, I think it's one reason I really like podcasts, because like you're saying, you might have three people tell you exactly the same thing, but in their own way, and only one of those person's explanations might be the one that connects with me, Nick, or you, Chris. Yeah. You know, it's sometimes somebody says something in a certain way that resonates with an individual, and that's why I think it's important to, as you say, be flexible, keep an open mind, love listening to different conversations and different explanations from different people, because that's how we learn. That's a great point.
Well, you know, it's the old light bulb moments,
yeah,
isn't it? You know, you're there, and all of a sudden something just, like, you know, out of the blue, try this.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, you know, it's just, you know, you've got somebody over a hill, you know, and they're up and running again.
Yeah. Yep. All right. This next one, we could do an entirely separate episode on the stuff in this next one, and we probably will at some point, but give us some thoughts on why we might miss based on having the wrong gauge, choke, or load for the quarry.
Well, the when you say quarry, are we talking about birds now or clay targets?
Yeah, birds. Or? Birds.
Birds. The things, it's actually a combination of things, you know, like a poorly fitting shotgun. You know, in other words, the guy goes in, buys a silver pigeon one, I'm just pulling that out the act from anything, and he shoots that gun regardless of his height, his build, anything, and he shoots pretty well with it, but he'll, you know, what they always say is you never shoot to your full potential, but he's happy and he's doing things. But I think you have to find the right shotgun and gauge to match, you know, if you're bird shooting. Simple stuff in my thing, a small gauge, you know, a small gauge, small bird,
yeah.
Or a small bird, small gauge. You know, and then the birds being shot, you know, 410s and so on and so forth. It's the different gauges, and it's just strength, size, everything. What are you shooting? You know, the last thing you want to do, in my opinion, is take a 12 gauge out to shoot a quail. And I just think, therefore, if you've only got a 12 gauge, shoot a light load in it.
Yeah.
But if you're able to, you know, maybe, you know, for your dove and quail shooting, if you get the opportunities, maybe a 20 gauge, you know, which is a good all rounder as well. If you think of the 12 and the 20, they're probably the most used two shotguns.
Yeah.
I hate to say makers' names, they're not an expensive gun. You know, the entry level guns, and that entry level gun is exactly the same ballistically as the top of the range gun. That the barrels will be from the same, you know, manufacturer, and everything else will be, you know, much the same. So people can shoot a gun on a budget, and hopefully they pass out of college, or hopefully they win the lottery, and then they can go out and buy the custom gun of their choice.
Yeah, indeed. Well, what about chokes? Because I know that's that was a topic in your Instinctive Shot book. And you've got some thoughts around chokes. It's one that we can very easily get carried away with, right? Because it's this feature on a gun that we can, with a wrench or sometimes even just with our fingers, we can change it. So it's naturally, it's something we think about, something we change. But what should we know about chokes, Chris?
Well, chokes, you know, originally were just to extend the range of the shotgun. You know, the pellets back in that era were soft lead. You know, they didn't have antinomy. And so the pellets deformed, you know, so they used at like a larger shot size as such to get the deformity, you know, into the forcing cone, down the barrel, and out through the choke.
Yep.
Well, times have changed. You know, they've got monolithium chrome lined barrels. They've got really top grade cartridges, and even the cheapest thing you can buy in Walmart or somewhere, you know, are going to be better cartridges than they used to be 20 years, 30 years ago. And so what you've got is you want to shoot a cartridge that doesn't knock the filling out of your teeth,
yeah,
but gets the job done. And if you haven't got any choke system in the gun, most guns now come with an adjustable comb, adjustable choke or adjustable comb. And I just think that it's you shoot a cartridge that's got the you need to go to the pattern plate basically to see how your gun patterns at different yardages with the different chokes, because you get a set of four or five multi chokes, and you need to go to the pattern plate and spray a little dot on it. Obviously, wear glasses so if there's any pellet reach in it. And if it's a child, you'd be using an adult to do it for you. And you impact test the gun to see if it shoots point of aim or if it shoots high or low, because then that can be adjusted on the comb. You know, you can, if it's an adjustable comb, it's fine. If not, there's ways of making it fit. And then after that, you turn around and make sure, as I say, it fits and it's all done and set up. And then the person, they you can get them, and from there you can build on it. I quite like letting them shoot the pattern plate, so that you know, obviously glasses on and everything else. But when they shoot the pattern plate, they see their shot cloud, and
yeah,
it's this little circle of pellets and everything. Well, it gives them an idea of what's actually going down range. There's this little ball of shot, and you know, it isn't this great cloud that everybody or a lot of people think that, mm-hmm, you can't miss with a shotgun because it's got this big cloud of shot. Well, unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. It's just the center column down the middle of the cartridge that's protected. So when the cartridge slams back on the face, the pellets at the back of the cartridge case, they get deformed. It then goes in the forcing cone, and it opens, and they get deformed again. And then they go down the barrel, and it's like rub-a-dub-dub-dum all the way down, and they're getting faceted. And then they finally go out the choke system, and they get squidged by the choke. So a lot of the pellets are deformed and faceted, and they're the ones that peel back. If you ever see a picture of like a tadpole, and the ones that really count are the ones right down the middle of the stream, and they're the ones that have been protected like all the way down the barrel, and so they fly accurately, and you only get about 10 to 12 pellets out of that. You'll get more if you shoot them at a closer range or anything, but as they go down, air resistance. And I think that that the antinomy, if you're going to be a serious competition shooter, bird shooter, whatever it is, you'll see that they will all pay that extra money for the cartridges they use.
Yeah, yeah. And that's,
yeah,
you're referring to the antimony content in the lead, which makes the pellets harder and less likely to deform, which increases.
Yeah, and so your swarm, you know, your shot swarm going out,
yeah,
it's just, you know, superbly efficient,
yeah,
compared to lead that's getting deformed, and you're getting more flyers. So you're getting that core that's essential is getting, what's the word for it? It's not dissolving, but it's breaking down as it goes along.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, that is a lot of great information, Chris, and hopefully that gives some listeners something to think about. Maybe a few more excuses built into our when we miss birds this season, and hopefully more importantly than that, maybe we've got some things that we can work on and improve our shooting.
There's just a couple of little things out at the end, but which we're not going to have to do it. But I just put poorly fitting shotguns creates bad results.
Yes.
Yeah, that was just, you know, the thing, and then it's important that the right shotgun and gauge to match, i.e. birds being shot with a 410 or you know, small gauge cartridges or through 12 gauges. And there's people that are shooting, you know, you don't have to have 10 shotguns or anything like that. But if you're going to be an upland bird shooter, a 20 is perfect, or a 16, or you know, I think a lot of people shoot 28s, but I'm just saying it, or 20 is fine. Whereas is it the arrow or is it the Indian again? It's one of those things where getting the gun fit, working with someone or working yourself, working it through with friends on the pattern board and shooting targets and looking at the videos and going online and seeing how people's stance, posture, head position, the gun mount practicing in the mirror and everything else. And those are the fundamentals that create the good shots.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as I mentioned a couple times, you've got a few books out. I would highly recommend to anybody listening to this episode, if they're interested, your book, The Instinctive Shot, A Practical Guide to Modern Wing Shooting. Fantastic book, great resource, ton of stuff in there. They've probably heard me talk about many of the things I read in there over many, many episodes. So I would definitely recommend folks check that book out if interested. I'll put a link to the show notes. Chris, you do gun fittings. You do instruction. What other things do you do? Talk about the gun fitting just briefly, and let folks know how to look that up and maybe get in touch with you.
Well, they once again, if you've got the money, you have a gun that's made to measure, like you'd have a suit made to measure or a pair of shoes. If you haven't got that, the place to go is, it depends on your height, weight, and your budget. And it comes down to, I just think that you go to the club and find somebody who, there's always people who are happy to help, especially the youth teams and the youth people, and get him to, and most people like I have got a little semi-auto or a break action 20 gauge or something, and you can take them out, show them gun safety, work your way through that, show them how to work the gun and everything, let them shoot a few targets, nothing special, something going up in the air, just hanging there, so you ignite the interest and the buzz of that first clay break, in which ensures our shooting will go on for another generation. And then it's a matter of if they like it, helping them along, and hopefully we'll all be shooting together for a long, long time.
Absolutely. Well, I really do appreciate the time, Chris. A lot of our customers at Upland Gun Company have been down to do gun fittings with you, and they all rave about it. They love going to shoot with you, and appreciate everything you do, and I appreciate you taking some time to join us on the podcast today. This has been a lot of fun.
Okay, then, Andrew, you take care.
Have a great day, Chris.
Bye. Bye-bye now.
Bye. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast, presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.